Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, the life and death consequences of living in a segregated community. We'll explain in a few minutes. But first, history is filled with interesting and important events that are sometimes obscured by the passage of time or by other events. Most of us are familiar with Lewis and Clark and their Corps of Discovery expedition, the long trek from St. Louis to the Oregon Territory and the Pacific, commissioned by President Thomas Jefferson. Just a few years after Lewis and Clark returned, another expedition left St. Louis with a similar destination, the purpose of which was to establish a global trade network based in the Pacific Northwest. It was the dream of John Jacob Astor, a wealthy New York merchant who financed the trip. Like Lewis and Clark, Astor worked with then ex-president Thomas Jefferson to realize his dream. It's a remarkable story and told in fascinating detail by author Peter Stark in his book Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Peter Stark joins us by phone from Wisconsin. Peter, a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here, Don.
I have to tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I picked it up thinking it would be an interesting read, but it was fascinating in more ways than one. Great job.
Thank you very much.
If you would, let's begin by having you set the stage as to what was going on at the time, and in particular, what John Jacob Astor was up to.
Well, the stage was set, as you said, by Lewis and Clark, and it was actually set a little bit before that by Captain Cook and his men. And as you know, in the late 1700s, the Pacific was still really unexplored and unmapped territory. Captain Cook explored it and mapped it in the 1770s, and his men discovered that they could buy a sea otter fur on Vancouver Island, which is in the Northwest, what we call the Pacific Northwest. They could buy a sea otter fur for about $1 in worth of trinkets. And the sea otter fur is the most luxurious fur in the world, 1 million hairs per square inch. They could take that fur, that unusual fur, and take it across the Pacific and sell it in China to the mandarins, who used it to trim their robes, for the equivalent of $100. So there was this tremendous profit motive to trade furs in the Pacific Northwest. Astor had a vision of what, as you say, a global trade empire. And what he would do is, what his plan was, his vision, was to send ships from New York with trade goods around Cape Horn to the Pacific Northwest. And there his ships would trade with the coastal Indians for sea otter furs, and also collect furs from a large network of fur posts that he would establish in the interior, and take those furs across the Pacific on his ships to China, sell them in China for a huge markup. With those ships and the profits, he would buy Chinese luxury goods, teas, silks, porcelains, load his ships with those, bring them back around the rest of the globe, and sell those Chinese luxury goods in London and New York for a tremendous markup again. So his vision was to have a fleet of ships continuously circling the globe, making tremendous profits at every stop. That was his vision.
It was really, really an ambitious project, wasn't it?
It was a hugely ambitious project. And at that point, we just have to remember that the West Coast was extremely remote from European civilization. It was, to get from New York to the West Coast was a 25,000-mile trip around Cape Horn. And the Northwest and the West Coast was one of the most wild remaining coastlines on Earth at this point. Of course, there were Native American tribes, but there were no European colonies on that a stretch of coast, basically 2,000 miles long. There were a couple of Russian fur posts way up in Alaska, and there were the Spanish settlements in Mexico and a few small missions in what's now California, the southern part of California. But between what's now Southern California, between what's now San Francisco and way up in Alaska, that was all a huge unclaimed stretch of territory, unclaimed by Western powers. an area that's basically the size of Europe. So Astor saw that as the potential region from which to draw his trade, his fur trade. And Thomas Jefferson had bought into that vision too, but he saw it as a slightly different entity, that he saw Astor's attempt to establish the first colony on the West Coast as as planting the seeds of democracy, and that an empire of liberty would spread from that side of the continent, from the west side of the continent, to the east side, where the fledgling United States was already being established on the eastern seaboard. And so Jefferson saw this West Coast enterprise of Astor's as really a kind of a sister democracy to the United States.
To accomplish that, you really had to plant the flag. You just couldn't claim it without having a presence there.
You had to have a presence there. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's easy as a colonial power. It's easy enough to say, "Oh, I'm claiming this land." It's another thing to establish yourself altogether. And the United States didn't start out. Jefferson wasn't thinking of it as a colonial power, but he was thinking of it as what he called an empire of liberty.
Yeah, we'll get to this a little bit later, but Britain also had designs on that part of the world and also as part of its fur trade operations.
Exactly. And if things had gone differently, you know, I talk about how the whole West Coast of North America could have ended up being an entire different entity altogether, and we can talk about that a little bit more later about the historical significance of Astor's empire.
Sure, there are a lot of what ifs in this story.
There are a lot of what ifs.
We'll get to as many as we can as time will allow. Well, let's talk about the expedition. It was a two-pronged expedition, one by land and one by sea. Why two-pronged?
Well, Astor was a meticulous planner, and he was the son of a butcher from Waldorf, Germany. And if you think of the name Astor and the name Waldorf, you can put together the name of a hotel in New York.
Sure.
The founder of that family line that eventually established the hotel. But he left Germany as a very young man, and he was always thinking far ahead. And he came to the United States when it was just right after the Revolutionary War. And he had with him some finely made musical instruments and some advice from a fur trader he met on board ship, who said, you can make a lot of money in the fur trade in North America. And Astor eventually did. But he achieved that by planning very, very meticulously. So the two-pronged expedition was an effort, essentially two advance parties, one going by sea around Cape Horn and the other by land on the Lewis and Clark route. And he wanted the two expeditions to meet at the mouth of the Columbia and establish this, what he called a great trade emporium. And that he wanted to make sure that there was a way to, he was hoping for a what they called a line of communications by land between the United States and the West Coast. And so St. Louis, of course, played a very significant role in this, that there was no way to get a message from the West Coast overland to the East Coast. And Astor hoped to establish some sort of line of communication. And so that's one reason he sent this land expedition. And another reason to send the land expedition was to establish a huge network of fur posts in the interior of the North American continent, a huge, wide-ranging network that would all funnel their furs into his emporium at the mouth of the Columbia. The seagoing expedition was necessary because you couldn't take that much in terms of supplies by traveling overland. And you really needed a big ship to carry what was essentially starting a colony on the West Coast, the West Coast equivalent of Jamestown. So that's why you needed a ship, and then you needed the land expedition to establish a line across the continent.
Most of the book focuses on the land expedition, and the seafaring part of it is fascinating in its own right. But we're talking about a 2,000-mile stretch of land that was populated by Indians, some friendly, some very much not so, and also some extraordinarily rugged terrain. I can't imagine the type of people who would take on an expedition like that, just head out into nowhere as this group did.
It's remarkable, you know, from our point of view now to think about striking off into the unknown the way these people did. And, you know, it took a special breed that there were on the overland expedition. There were a lot of French Canadian voyageurs. There were Scottish fur traders. They were known as the experts in the fur trade. There were fur traders usually from Montreal, and American hunters. And then the expedition was led by a 27-year-old New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt. And he was a really interesting character in that he was a very nice guy. He was very smart. He was a good businessman. He was very loyal to Astor. He liked to lead by consensus. He liked to poll everybody before making a decision. But his great drawback was that he'd never been in the wilderness before. And he was leading a 60-person party across the continent on the Lewis and Clark route, and that lack of experience caused all sorts of problems in route.
Well, that and knowing that there were some very hostile Indians out there as well. I have to take a break now, Peter Stark. We'll do that. Come back and continue the conversation and get into some of the specifics about the hardships that these folks faced. And we'll do that in just a moment. I'm talking with Peter Stark, the author of Astoria, John Jacob Astor, and Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Peter Stark, the author of Astoria, John Jacob Astor, and Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire. We have to move along a little bit in the story, Peter. I think we should point out that things went reasonably well until they realized, this is the overland group, that they had to make a detour.
Exactly. They got as far as St. Louis. You know, they were supposed to follow the Lewis and Clark route up the Missouri and down the Columbia, over the Rockies and down the Columbia. And as they got to St. Louis, they heard more and more stories about the ferocity of the Blackfeet Indians at the headwaters of the Missouri up in what's now today's Montana. And they started up the Missouri, this 60-person party led by Hunt. And as they got up, the stories got worse as they were going up the river. And one day, they were about 1,000 miles up, there were three Kentuckians coming down river in a canoe, three Kentucky trappers. One of them was wearing a scarf. Underneath the scarf, he bore the scars of a scalping. And they said, "You really don't want to go up that way. But we know a better way. We know a shortcut." It wasn't a shortcut. It was a long cut. But it was a way that would avoid going through Blackfeet territory at the headwaters of the Missouri and would skirt south of Blackfeet territory. So Hunt, after a lot of deliberation, decided to leave the river, leave the known route, leave Astor's instructions, and strike off into this huge chunk of unexplored terrain. They spent 4 months. He traded for 118 horses. They left their river boats, loaded their 10 or 15 tons of gear on 118 horses, and spent 4 months riding and trekking across what's now would be South Dakota, Wyoming, into Idaho. They crossed several big mountain ranges. They ended up near what's today Jackson Hole, Wyoming, crossed the Teton Mountains, and the three Kentucky trappers said, "Okay, see this little river here? Well, we think that leads to the Pacific Ocean, so you can just build canoes and paddle down it." Of course, no one really knew where the river went.
Operative words were, "we think."
This is where it's flowing west, so it must They must go to the Pacific. And so Hunt was not so sure about building canoes, but the voyageurs were pretty sick of walking at this point. They liked to paddle. So he went with their idea to build canoes, and they built 15 huge canoes, loaded all these tons of gear and trade goods into the canoes, and set off with this 60-person party down this small river. And the first day, everything went really well. It was the current was fast. They were making good mileage. There were a few snow flurries because Hunt had dawdled along the way. He'd never been in the mountains in winter before, so he didn't realize the consequences of winter in the mountains. So he wasn't really in a hurry. So the first day after they build canoes, you know, they make good mileage on smooth, fast water. A few snow flurries, but not bad. They, because it's late October. The second day down this unknown river, they hit a few riffles. The third day, they hit some rapids and swamped two canoes. The fourth day, it gets worse. The fifth day, still worse. And by the ninth day, voyageurs are drowning. Canoes are smashing into rocks and breaking apart. They're going over waterfalls and huge rapids, and suddenly they can't go forward. They're stuck in this chasm full of rapids, and they are running out of food, and it is now early November. So they set off, unable to paddle further. They set off on foot along the river, and they trek for another month just scavenging they eat a few beavers and beaver skins. They eat, they find some Indians, trade with them for a few dogs to eat. They manage to straggle on for another 10 or another month. And at that point, they end up in the deepest canyon in North America, the Hell's Canyon of the Snake River, in the middle of winter with no food. And the men start dropping by the side of the trail. Well, there's no trail, by the side of the river. And now Hunt has to make another big decision, whether to stick with his loyal but dying men or to lead the rest of his party out to safety.
I should point out a couple of things here. Among the things that they were eating when they ate anything at all were their moccasins. And also there was a woman, a part of the kind of a Sacagawea of this particular expedition. And I found her story remarkable, the fact that she was pregnant and at one point was walking 100 miles or so in full pregnancy, and then just went out and had the baby all by herself, put it on her hip the next day, and off again.
Exactly. She's really sort of a super Sacagawea character, and she had two small boys with her, a boy 4 years old and a boy 2 years old. She was the wife of the interpreter, Pierre Dorion Jr., and she probably knew or at least ran into Sacagawea in the course of this journey, or in St. Louis just before leaving on this journey. She didn't really want to go. Her husband more or less made her go, and she had more endurance than the men themselves. They were astounded by how she could walk, you know, seemingly forever, both with these two boys and while she was pregnant. And that she had a baby in the middle of winter, and showed up back in camp the next day as if nothing had happened. And Hunt said it was just remarkable. She was going on as if nothing had happened at all.
She hopped on a horse the next day with that baby, and off they went. Apparently, according to your book, and I certainly trust what you've written, it was commonplace for Indian women, when they were about to have the baby, just to go off into the woods and have it and then come back.
Yes, yeah, that there was not a – it was something that could be done alone, or with very little assistance. One of the reasons they – the Marie Dorion, the woman that we're talking about, would walk for great distances while she was pregnant, apparently, according to some of the cultural background, was that women believed that the baby, the child gestating inside them, was a would take on the power of what was going on in the outside world. So if the mother was walking great distances, the child would grow into a strong warrior. So she had an incentive to really exert herself during this journey.
Sure. As time begins to unfold for us, I want to return to the sea voyage for a moment. What was going on when all of this was happening on the Overland route? What was going on with the was the Tonquin? Is that the name of the ship that was?
Yeah, Tonquin or Tonquin, either way.
Mm-hmm. What was going on at this point with the ship?
Well, the ship they had some leadership problems there with the ship as well. That the captain of the ship was a 30-year-old U.S. naval hero named Jonathan Thorne, and he was known to be fearless in battle. He was a great guy to have on your side if you were in a sea battle against a foreign power. But his great drawback was that he'd never been the captain of a commercial ship before, and this ship that he was in the captain of was this motley collection. It had a motley load of passengers of French-Canadian voyageurs and Scottish fur traders and these cheeky young Scottish clerks. So Captain Thorne, who's steeped in the tradition of military naval discipline, didn't know how to handle this load of passengers he had of Astor's people. And the first night out at sea, this is in September 1810, they're off of his first night out of New York Harbor. Thorne says, 8 p.m., lights out, military discipline. And all these voyageurs and Scottish fur traders and clerks are on deck smoking and socializing. And they're saying, no, we're not going to bed. We're not ready for bed. And Thorne says, yes, you are. And they say, no, we're not. In fact, Mr. Astor gave us shares in this enterprise. We own part of the ship. And Thorne spins to them, to the Scottish fur traders, and says, the first man to disobey my orders aboard my own ship, I'll blow his brains out. Well, relations deteriorated from that point forward aboard the Tonquin.
As one might suspect.
And they got as far as the Falkland Islands, and Captain Thorne tried to abandon the Scottish fur traders and sail away without them.
We don't want to give away too much of the story because we certainly want people to read the book. But another fascinating part of the voyage was actually arriving, jumping ahead at the Columbia River, and then having to find a way to get inland. I mean, there was an obstacle there that was a terrific obstacle for them.
A terrific obstacle at the mouth of the Columbia. Even today, it's one of the most dangerous navigation hazards in the world. It's called the Columbia Bar, and it's a four-mile-long sandbar that forms where all the force of the Columbia River goes out and all the power of the Pacific comes in, and they meet there, and these powerful forces wrestle with each other over across the bar. There's one channel through the bar. That's what Thorne had to find to land his ship inside the mouth of the Columbia. Well, they arrived in March of 1811 off the mouth of the Columbia, a very stormy period and huge waves, you know, screaming gale-like winds. And Thorne was in a tremendous hurry to fulfill his mission, and he ordered his longboat to down immediately to go rowing off to find the channel through the Columbia Bar. His officers were saying, you know, we're gonna die if we go out in this kind of weather in a long boat. And Thorne said to Mr. Fox, he said, his officer, well, Mr. Fox, if you're afraid of water, you should have stayed back in Boston and sent him out into the storm. Well, the long boat rowed out a few hundred yards and disappeared, never to be seen again. Thorne ended up losing nine men crossing the Columbia Bar. Or trying to find the channel for the Columbia Bar. They finally found the channel. The Tonquin crossed it, bumped a few times on the bar, and made it inside the river's mouth. And they actually unloaded and started establishing Astor's Emporium, his colony on the Pacific.
Well, let's leave the rest of the Thorne story to the readers because it gets pretty interesting from this point on. Meantime, the Overland Expedition is making its way, and let's leave the trials and tribulations they were facing to the readers and get them to the Emporium.
So do we want to hear how they managed to escape their predicament?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so. Hunt leaves behind the men who are failing along in the canyon, and he gives them two beaver pelts to survive on, to eat. He goes on. The rest of his party is already scattered. They've gone ahead of him. He finally catches up to them. He leads them out. They get to a Shoshone Indian village about 10 days' walk away, and an encampment, essentially. And Hunt at this point realizes he'll perish without a guide. He really needs somebody to guide him, and he can't convince an Indian to be his guide because it's winter and the Indians are saying you don't want to travel in the winter across the mountains. You need to stay put here until spring. And Hunt essentially shames one of the Indians, the Shoshone, into leading him and his party over the Blue Mountains in what's now northeastern Oregon. Marie Dorion has her baby at the base of the mountains. The baby ends up dying of exposure at the top of the mountains during brutal cold and snow. The whole party almost perishes on crossing the Blue Mountains from starvation. They finally stumble down the other side. And they come out of a valley, or out of a little gully, which suddenly opens up, and it opens up into this big, beautiful green valley. It's covered with grass, and they come to an encampment of 2,000 horses and an Indian encampment with 2,000 horses. And they know at that point they're saved. That there's that's all the meat they could ever eat right there. They eventually make it to Astoria, to the mouth of the Pacific. And they with Hunt in charge, they start establishing this colony at the mouth of the Columbia, and they start realizing Astor's great vision for what this great global trade empire, this vision that saw the Pacific as a center of global trade in the way that the Atlantic was in their day. This is, you have to remember, the Pacific is so remote at this point, so uncharted, that it nobody thought of it as a global center of trade. When we think of it now, this is the era of the Pacific with the Pacific Trade Agreement and whatnot. But if Astor had his way, it would have been that we would have been the era of the Pacific would have been 200 years ago. So he started establishing his men started establishing this great empire, and due to various shortcomings of leadership, Hunt wandering off around the Pacific when he should have stayed put in Astoria.
Well, he went to Hawaii. Who can blame him?
He went to Hawaii after that overland trip. He was so wiped out. He went off to Hawaii and the Marquesa Islands. who can blame him? But he wasn't on the spot to lead the colony, the Emporium at the mouth of the Columbia. And meanwhile, Thorne ran into his own problems, which were very dramatic ones, which I won't go into here. But it undermined the Astor's leadership on the Pacific. And at this point, what happened was the War of 1812 broke out in the Atlantic, which made the Astor's colony at the mouth of the Pacific a potential prize of war for the British Royal Navy. And the rival Canadian fur barons convinced the Royal Navy to send warships around Cape Horn to capture Astor's colony because they wanted it for their own. They wanted it for their own emporium on the mouth of the Pacific. So what happened ultimately was the guy who was the leader of Astoria, the second in command, guy named McDougall was a duplicitous fellow, and he sold Astor out, and that he essentially undermined the whole enterprise. There were other reasons why it didn't come to fruition the way Astor had hoped too, but it ended up having this considerable historical importance, and I mean, this might be a moment to address that a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
So what happened was, even though the Astor's vision didn't come to be the way he had hoped, nor Jefferson's, what happened was that Hunt, for all his stumblings around in the canyons of the West, established the route that finally became the Oregon Trail many years later. The result of the War of 1812 was when it was finally settled under a peace treaty, not much change between Britain and the United States, and it was agreed on this question of what's going on in the Pacific that both the United States and Great Britain were free to occupy this northwest region, this huge strip of the west coast, and this area that essentially the size of Europe. And so it was a joint occupation agreement. So that huge chunk of the continent remained in limbo, at least in terms of European powers and Western powers, for the next 30 or 40 years, that it was under joint occupation. And yet more and more people started to look that way for settlement and to open up new terrain, and their westward movement ended up growing from the United States to settle new territory. And when that cry of manifest destiny started in the 1820s in Congress, when people started saying, we are destined as a people, we Americans are destined as a people to go across the continent and establish our country all the way across the continent to the Pacific, they pointed to Astor's flag that he had planted at the mouth of the Columbia in 1811 as being the first colony on the Pacific, and it was an American colony. So America was destined to take the West Coast.
A very important story, obviously. We just have a minute left. Why do you think it has sort of been forgotten by history?
Well, I think for two reasons. One is because it was in limbo. This whole chunk of territory was in limbo for 30 years. It didn't have a clear resolution until the wagon train started coming out on the Oregon Trail, and eventually the border was established between Canada and the U.S., where it is now. And the second reason I think it's been forgotten is that, or largely forgotten, is that it's so overshadowed by Lewis and Clark. Yeah. And the heroism of Lewis and Clark, and those are the great American heroes we hold up. And we don't see how these failures of people like Astor actually led to great, you know, how his vision played out historically. We just see the winners and not really how the losers.
Well, it's a great read, and we left a lot of questions unanswered here intentionally, so people will read the book. Peter Stark, thank you for being with us. The book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Don. I really enjoyed it.
Coming up next, community longevity threatened by segregation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.